Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Tuesday, November 23rd, 2010 Carver Board of Aldermen meeting. Tonight is a public hearing. Before we commence our public hearing, however, I would like to take a moment to just recognize former Alderman Jay Bryan to come up to the podium for a moment.
And poet laureate.
And poet.
Thank you. I know it's a little unusual to have a comment before you have these public hearings, but I appreciate the mayor allowing me to do that. My name is Jay Bryan, and I am the town poet laureate. I have two matters I want to share with you. I will hand you an article after I'm finished by Catherine Stripling Beyer, which I think is a wonderful name, who was a poet laureate for North Carolina. And she writes in this article about the effect of reading of poetry on our nation's public discourse, and more particularly, the need for our nation's leaders to read poetry. Using the recent elections as an example, she contends that the power and poetry of public language has been undermined by TV ads and the daily spin, hype, and money spent by candidates and corporations. She urges those in positions of public leadership to return to reading poetry, to remind them of what it means to be a human being, and how we ought to behave in relation to one another. And in the words of the poet Richard Wilbur, to dwell in poetry's prodigious honesties. So I encourage you to continue reading your favorite poetry and to call upon the words from those readings in your public speaking. And in so doing, enhance the beauty and understanding of what you say to those who are listening. I would also suggest that poetry can be therapeutic after a long evening of street closings and budget intricacies and public hearings. With these thoughts in mind and in the spirit of Thanksgiving, I would like to read a poem of mine about Carrboro's firefighters and the building, and in honor of the building of the radiant and alive fire station on Homestead Road. I want to acknowledge the help of former fireman Wayne Laycock. In the poem, you will hear a metaphoric reference to what is known as an escape fire. This is a device not often used where a fire is lit in advance of another fire. Fighters get in the burned out space and the fire goes around them. I will say that there's certainly no certain number of words that can adequately capture what firefighters risk and do. The poem is called Ocean of Fire. Months sharpening axes, retesting masks, waiting for this call, this moment, when you and I sleep with pets curled in a circle, coals in the wood stove, dreams working the day's riddles. This moment when neighbors wake to an ocean of flames, swallowing family photographs and Bible from the 18th century. Lives in their gloved hands, fighters arrive to the unknown, of foam rubbers cyanide, pesticides under the sink, collapsing floors that drop them into a melting blast. Arrive to collide with fire's lash, an unholy roar from smoke starved for oxygen exploding, and with a fog nozzle beat back its snarl, snaking under curling clapboard. The blaze calls to them its siren song from fire's first ever spark, from fiery mountaintop beacons warning fellow castles of attack. Now a flashover from orange flickers that may trap them in their protective suits, lost in a hallway, stealing their breath before they reach the ones they hope to save. In its yellow and cold gold tapestry, an escape fire to lay in, pray in, to wait for a mutable fate to blow by, and to inhale the cosmos love burning around and over them and in each of us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jay.
Thank you. I do not think that there is a harder working poet laureate in all of North Carolina than our Jay.
Thank you, Jay. With that, we'll turn to public hearing number one. Actually, can I suggest public hearing one is on a land use ordinance amendment related to stormwater control and a whole bunch of acronyms. There are five people who are signed up to speak on item three, and I'm just wondering whether maybe we should reverse one and three in the order on the agenda. Is that?
Is there anyone here particularly interested in one?
Hearing
then I
on.
Agree.
Yeah. Okay. Given that's the case, then let's begin with item A3, a continuation of public hearing to consider land use ordinance text amendment related to flag lots and minimum lot widths. Mr. Manager.
This is a continuation from the public hearing that began on October 26th. And Trish McGuire, Planning Administrator, has some additional information to share based on inquiries from the board at the last public hearing. So, Trish, if you'll do your presentation and then follow with the public hearing.
Certainly. Thank you. Good evening, everyone. This item did start at a hearing in June. A miscellaneous text amendments at that time included among those were changes to the minimum lot width provision dealing with minimum lot widths. And then staff considered the board's comments at that time from that hearing and made some additional provided some additional components in this ordinance. And at the meeting on October 26th, you requested some follow-up, and so here we are. I do have this slide about why changes are proposed. I can go back to that if you would like me to. The ordinance currently does include the definition of a flag lot, and that was one of the changes that was included in the provisions we prepared over the summer. The map here, or the illustration on the screen, represents sort of the way we would evaluate whether a lot is a flag or not. But the definition refers to a lot being regularly shaped and the buildable portion of the lot being connected to the street by an arm of the lot that's less than 50% of the presumptive minimum required lot width. And so there's also a provision for lots such as the lots in the B4 zoning district, the B1C and the B1G, where there's no minimum lot width provided in the ordinance. But in the this example is from the R10 zoning district. In that zoning district, this lot is the presumptive or recommended lot width is 75 feet. The 50% of that is 37.5 feet. So a flag would be of less than 37.5 feet would result in a lot that was considered a flag lot. And in these examples, these two lots, 5 and 6, have 10-foot wide flags, so they would both be considered flag lots.
And under the proposed changes, that wouldn't be allowed?
No, it would be allowed, but the process to approve one would be different than it would be otherwise.
So the 10-foot wouldn't turn to 24 feet?
No.
No.
It would not turn to 24 feet. That's correct.
And what, so what would the difference, so what would the alternative or the change in process be?
Well, the change is that these lots would not meet the definition of a minor. Would lots that were created with flag lots, if flag lots were included in the subdivision wouldn't meet the definition of a minor subdivision. And so by definition, or by the absence of that, meeting that criteria, it would become a major subdivision if a flag lot is included. So that means if a lot was a subdivision, normally a subdivision of up to four lots is considered a minor, but in this instance, the principal change is that those lots now under five lots, which are minors now, would become majors. They would go to the Board of Adjustment for review.
So a four-lot subdivision is something that the staff reviews rather than
exactly.
The Board of Adjustment.
Right.
And the difference being whether it goes to advisory boards and public hearings and things of that nature.
That's
but
right.
But if a four-lot, assuming this got adopted, then if a four-lot subdivision had a flag lot included in it, it would have to go to that higher level of review.
Yes.
From the Board of Adjustment.
Yes.
What if someone said, okay, I'm just going to do three lots and then later on do the fourth lot, which would make two separate. Could you do that? And then you'd have two exempt subdivisions and it would go to staff instead of going to the Board of Adjustment.
The number of lots isn't the criteria that would move the development or the subdivision up into the category of major. It is the presence of a flag lot, whether it is three lots or two lots or four lots.
Okay.
That is the criteria that's in the change.
And what if it is one lot? Because, like, throughout old downtown, there are a whole lot of houses built behind other houses throughout back there and throughout. So would one lot
creating one new lot, or in other words, that would be what we would call a two-lot subdivision. You're creating one new one, but you're also leaving one old one behind, so it's two lots.
So if you're just building one house behind another house, and it is a flag lot, that would kick this in?
That is.
And it would add all of these procedures, so we would never have that happen then.
Well,
you couldn't afford. Well, anyway, go on, but. Yeah.
Continue.
So for just one lot, this would keep.
I know there are a bunch of people here who are
yeah.
wanting to understand what the proposal is.
Sure. No, thank you for the questions.
Just related to this slide, so it says street frontage of every flag lot shall not be a minimum of 24 feet. So I guess that basically means with this rule, a lot, if it were 50 feet wide, this would be the minimum requirement?
No, that language in the draft ordinance, I can just place it up on the screen for you. Oops.
That language is already in the ordinance.
Right. And,
but it only applies to historic districts, which we don't have any. So, I mean, that's not
oh.
a change.
Okay, yes, in the historic district. All right, thanks.
Yeah, that's not a standard that would apply to flags.
Trish, can I also clarify that?
Yes.
That not only does the change affect the definition of minor subdivisions, but for example, if in that illustration there, if the original tract, it's shown as divided into 4, 5, and 6, if you can imagine it being 1, 2, and 3, and that had been a lot of 2 acres or less, they could have created that with no process by making an exempt subdivision. And the reason they can do that is because the statute provides for an exemption from the subdivision regulatory process of divisions of land or divisions of a tract of not more than 2 acres and not more than 3 lots where all of the dimensional requirements, if you will, of the ordinance are met with respect to the configuration of the lots. And they can do that now because flag lots are not prohibited. The main thrust of this amendment is to, by changing it so that, changing the ordinance or proposing to change the ordinance so that flag lots are not automatically allowed, then you would not be able to do that as an exempt subdivision. You could still potentially do it, but you'd have to go to the Board of Adjustment to do it, as opposed to now you come in and you just say, here's our plat, sign off on it, we have nothing to say about it.
Just to make sure I and others understand you, Mr. Attorney, you're saying right now if somebody divides an acre and a half into 3 half-acre lots, assuming that complies with density requirements and so forth for the town, that would be an exempt subdivision. They could have, they can configure their lots kind of however they want with respect to flag lots, but after this change, that wouldn't be true?
That is correct, that it would not be an exempt. It would not be
would,
exempt from the process.
They could still do it, but it would be
they
kicked out of the exempt category.
They could still potentially do it, Right. If they, again, demonstrate the criteria that it's not going to have an adverse effect on pre-existing developed properties.
So any flaglot, even if it's just one extra lot, kicks in this...
Sends you to the Board of Adjustment.
Sends you to the Board of Adjustment.
Which involves time and more money. Anyway.
But there are other people that live in those neighborhoods who are not protected by any plat or any homeowners association or any requirements on the ground. We're talking about a change in development and a change in intensity.
Well, I certainly understand that, Joel, but I think that there's a difference between one and five.
I think one could tip be the tipping point. And I think that the neighbors surrounding it should have the opportunity to know and speak to that at a hearing.
Mr. Manager.
I really just wanted to make the point that I think Joel just made. One of the primary reasons for staff bringing this to the board, and there are lots of policy considerations to consider, but one of the major changes is in the current ordinance, what you see here is something that would never be involved in any sort of a public process. The proposed changes would require a public process where neighborhood folks or other folks would have an opportunity to comment on the development where they don't have that opportunity now. That's that's very succinctly the biggest change is the public process piece.
Right.
Okay.
Go ahead. Slide number two.
Okay, so some other, all right. Number three, actually. These are some examples of other subdivisions with flaglots, and they're both existing and conceptual situations. And in the illustrations, the public street rights-of-way are all shown at the bottom of the slides, here, and down here. And then they're all oriented, so north is to the left in this slide, and so the circle shows where the flags are. In the case of this particular one, there's an easement that's created for joint access in this location to serve this flag lot here and to provide access from this lot down here. So there's a shared driveway for these three lots, and the same is true for these lots as well. In this example, there are a couple of different examples of lots of combinations of two and three lots being served. In some of these examples, more than one dwelling unit could be placed on the lots. So some of the lots are large enough for more than one dwelling unit, and that would affect how many units could be served by any particular driveway. But this is these are the kinds of circumstances that arise through the process of the creation of flag lots.
The one at the top right is a proposed somewhere.
It is. It is a conceptual.
Just the bottom left, they have one driveway that's serving three lots.
Yes.
How is that? I mean, it seemed like the flag lots were necessary because you needed to run water. Wasn't that one of the reasons? How is it that this one didn't need to make at least an extra driveway to run that one?
Because there's a sewer easement running through the middle of that, so the sewer is not in the street.
That's right. There was a sewer extension actually involved in this project. So.
Oh, okay. Thanks.
And so. But so there is an easement for access that's part of the flag is part of it is an actual lot and then part of it's an easement.
All right, thanks.
You're very welcome. So the requested follow-up, the board asked us to take the draft ordinance and flip those two sections, putting the language about the historic district and the 24-foot lot width, minimum lot width for the flag, and move that below the standard that Mr. Brough just mentioned regarding lot access and safety, and flip those in the draft ordinance so that it would be clear that the provision dealing with flag lots just was dealing with just to show you in here that this section is dealing with. This section previously was called flag lots in the historic district, and so the only language in there was the language on the under subsection, what is now subsection B, and that language does specify a minimum lot width, for the flag, et cetera. Now, these sections will only deal still with lots that are in the historic districts.
But we don't have a historic district.
We don't, and, but, I mean, we do have other provisions in the ordinance with which these section, that section coincides. So if there ever was to be a historic district, that language is there.
But that can make it, you know, having it in there when it's not in there. And a lot of people think of, like, Oak and Pine and back there as a historic district, but it really isn't because we don't have a historic district.
Right.
And so I think when you look at that, that can be, for the layperson, extremely confusing.
Yeah. And so that was the reason it was moved, so that that section was previously subsection A, and now it's subsection B, and subsection A is the top section.
Can it say under historic district that currently there is no historic district? Or to take effect if a historic district is established.
Or just pull it out to save it and stick it in if we ever get a historic district?
We would just have to
probably do either.
Change it if we had one.
I think to repeal it, you probably need to re-advertise, but I mean, it's just language that's been there for a long time, and you could either delete it or probably insert some parenthetical
I think
indication
that would address Jackie's concern that, you know, a person who doesn't understand all of the land use ordinance who's reading this doesn't confuse what's colloquially considered a historic district.
Yeah, I think that could be done with an editorial comment.
Thanks,
like you've got comments throughout the land use ordinance as to when things are amended. I think it would be just in parenthetical.
Just in parentheses.
Parenthetical
would you put
expression.
It everywhere in this reference?
The historic district, I mean, yeah. Stuff.
Because it's very
well, we could start with this for tonight.
Well, I mean,
well, if you
right, but I guess we're spending most of the time on the provision that has no effect at the present, so tell us about the provision you want.
Good idea.
You're proposing to adopt.
So subsection A is the new language in this section of the draft ordinance, and it deals with the fact that the Board of Adjustment or the Board of Aldermen, when approving subdivisions with within their respective jurisdictions, typically 5 to 12 or above more than 12 lots, may approve flag lots if they conclude that the access requirements set forth in 15.211 will be satisfied and such flag lot can be developed for purposes permissible in that district without creating any substantially adverse impact on adjoining developed properties. And that's sort of the principal standard that's proposed in this draft ordinance to deal with.
So, Trish, other than if it goes to the Board of Adjustment where you have public comment, how is the standard of review different, the way that staff looks at it versus the way the Board of Adjustment would look at it?
I have a couple of slides to go to run through that, and I think that we'll try to address that question.
Okay.
So number one, we did that. Number two, contact nonprofit affordable housing developers for feedback. We did that. Finished subdivision review for Mr. Gorfkel. We're working with Mr. Gorfkel on that point. Number four, provide information on, and he's also here tonight, he's one of the potential folks to speak. Provide information on special or conditional use permit process. So let me just run through those. So the nonprofit affordable housing developers, both James Harris and I met with folks from met with Robert Dowling, and also with Dolores Bailey, Tara Fikes, and Margaret Houth, and Lauren Clark, who are the staff to the Home Consortium, you know, our joint efforts in affordable housing, dealing with federal funds, and met together to talk about these issues and review the draft ordinance, essentially, and in so doing came up with these comments. First of all, there was the recommendation that rather than outright not allowing duplexes or multifamily units, that there be some way to for the draft ordinance to be modified so that they could be considered as a potential acceptable use in the same context that a flag lot is being considered in that context, that there'd be the opportunity for that to occur. So the language in the ordinance was revised to reflect that recommendation. That the public review, the public hearing, and additional time expected to be involved in the special use or a conditional use process if we've had such a situation is acceptable so long as the engineering and other information submittal requirements are not significantly different than they would be otherwise. I've got a description of that following, and then communicating with the neighbors, and then this general statement that the feeling was that communicating with neighboring property owners of these kinds of changes, that is to say, that development, infill development or flaglot development going in is better for affordable housing in general and specifically the future residents of those units. Staff's been working with Mr. Gorfkel to work on the review of his plat and identify options to create a lot around the existing house at 427 South Greensboro Street. Okay, an overview of the anticipated review process. First of all, we expect this process to be very similar to the one that's followed currently for watershed residential subdivisions of less than four or fewer lots. And that is in situations, and this is a point of emphasis, but where no present plan to develop the property exists, because there is a provision in the ordinance dealing with open space and recreation facilities that are about development versus about subdivision of land. And we're talking right now about the subdivision of land, not the development of property. So first and foremost, stormwater engineering is not needed in these typically in these situations. Usually there's little or no review by the town engineer of subdivisions like this. The submittal requirements would include a plat, an application form, the applicable fee, and any supporting explanatory information about whether or not there's a present plan to develop the property, et cetera. The plat would have to show lot sizes and measurements, access to the public road, configuration demonstrating that lots are buildable.
Do you know what the fee is under our current structure for, say, a single lot?
For one lot?
Yeah, for one lot under this proposal.
It's, I think it's $150 for a minor subdivision.
Okay, and currently there would be no fee for a flag lot, right, since they don't come into the system?
No. There, that would be the fee for a subdivision with involved creating a two-lot subdivision.
So the fee is the same under the new proposal as it is currently?
Well, I have a fee slide as well following.
Okay, great.
Did you ask me if the fee that we were recommending was $150 or?
I was asking if the fee is changing.
Okay.
What the difference would be.
Thanks. Anticipated review steps, the plat and supporting information. This happens now with exempt subdivisions, minor subdivisions, and major subdivisions. But the plat and any supporting information is distributed to staff and appropriate agencies. There are comments on the plat and resubmittal until the reviewers find that the application addresses regulations and plans, applicable regulations and plans. There's a request to set a public hearing if a CUP is involved. Special use permits, we don't have a request to set a public hearing step. The staff sends those items forward for the Board of Adjustments review without them specifically setting a hearing. Advisory board review and recommendations would take place. That's a new step in the process. That doesn't happen currently for the review of minor subdivisions or exempt subdivisions.
So that would be in all cases?
Even a two-lot subdivision would have to go before advisory board review.
Yes, as it's
if it had a flag lot.
Right, and then notice of public hearing to neighboring property owners and residents. So anticipated review, what is the land use ordinance looking at? The plat would have to identify stream buffers in any special flood hazard areas. The provision of a sidewalk would be brought into the conversation. This can happen in minor subdivisions as well, if the location is if it's shown as a place where a sidewalk is needed in the sidewalk master plan. That's the kind of thing that in a plat review would be addressed through a note on a plat rather than a detailed description of the construction of the sidewalk, et cetera. What would not be needed? Compliance with parking requirements, recreation and open space, stormwater review. Those are things that all would be addressed during the review of the application to actually build on the lots. And specifically, the open space and recreation facilities provisions, there is an exception for certain development situations. If a development doesn't involve the extension of creation of public streets or the extension of public facilities, utilities rather, and there's no plan to develop anything other than single family units, that is to say the lots are only large enough for single family units, then there is an exception to the open space and rec facilities requirements. But if a lot is large enough to support more than one unit, there would be a note added to the plat about the responsibility for that lot to address its open space and rec facilities requirements. And that's the case now. That happens in minor subdivisions presently.
Does it happen with exempt subdivisions as well?
It does not. We have never...
That's the kind of thing that exempt subdivisions are exempt from.
That's right.
Okay.
Anticipated review in regard to the public hearing itself. It would be a quasi-judicial proceeding, so, you know, sworn testimony, findings of fact. The permit issuing authority would be obliged to listen to the public input that's provided, but as, you know, you all do with, well, if you're one of these permit issuing authorities, you know, would be charged with making specific findings of fact and decisions based on those facts in order to be legitimate. Conditions related to driveway locations and the number of units served on a driveway, the good fit between those characteristics, and related standards for construction, as well as lot configuration, perhaps to preserve or protect existing larger specimen trees, are the kinds of things we anticipate would result from this review. A fee of $300, as is applied to the watershed residential subdivisions, is proposed, is suggested. It is the kind of fee that captures the cost of a public hearing notice, as well as, well, you know, a little bit of staff time. But the anticipated plat review process, so long as there's no present plan to develop the lots, is modeled largely on that process, so hence our proposal for that fee. Changes to the draft from October 26th. We made some revisions to Section 1 to clarify that the provisions do not apply to existing approved lots, although we might be tweaking that language because Mike was looking at it earlier.
Yeah, we probably will need to address that later.
Tweak which language? I'm sorry.
About the we've added some language to make it clear that lots that were approved by major as part of major developments permit, you know, preliminary plat approvals, like conditional use permits and so forth, that they're exempt, but I'm not sure we're absolutely there in terms of making it really clear that, as was the intention, that existing lots are not, existing undeveloped flag lots are not intended to be now, you know, not buildable now, as, you know, or not okay
any longer. Right. So somebody already had a flag lot that was platted from before.
Right. That wasn't the intention.
Right.
We've had some iterations of that language, and Mike's been looking at it. So, but that was the intention. And then another revision is to change the basic limitation to apply to flag lots, not any lots not meeting the presumptive lot width. And then again, to provide more, for more intensive use, so not just single family, if the permit issuing authority were to approve it. The draft ordinance also has two new sections, 5 and 6, that are included to clarify the site planning and concept review plan requirements that otherwise apply to special or conditional use permit applications are not intended to apply to subdivisions that have fewer than 5 lots. So these are just to make it clear that from a procedural standpoint, the expectation is not that minor subdivisions, what are currently minors and exempt subdivisions, would need to go through the walkabout, the site planning procedures, and et cetera. We had included two maps from the previous meeting, which just illustrated lots in town that are large enough to be subdivided based on just an analysis of their GIS, their land area, as it shows up in our GIS. And it has to be, in order to be shaded, it has to be at least 2 times the minimum lot size required for the zoning district. Now, some of these lots have buildings on them already. And then a close-up version of the ones that are shaded, shaded lots in the shaded lots are the lots that are vacant lots in town, where someone might where there's no buildings whatsoever.
How many do we know? How many those shaded are?
I think we counted 15 lots that were shaded before. But we did not go back and fifteen that were vacant flag lots to address the question we had earlier about applying to existing lots. Let's see. So that was the end of my the slides. I'm happy to try and answer any other questions.
How much time, you know, compared to the process that's now in place, say for a 2-lot subdivision? How much time would this add to the process, particularly when you put in the advisory boards and the you know, how much time could people look at adding to building?
Well, the average time for a small subdivision is probably about a month right now. And this would probably be on the order of up to 4 months, depending on the timing of the year and when, you know, if it was around a holiday or...
So
or there was some particularly difficult issue that came up with
this. Could be continued, obviously.
Right. So, yes. So for just a two-lot subdivision, somebody wants to build their kid a house in their backyard, it would go from very quick to maybe up to 4 months or longer. Okay.
But it's not the kid, the parent that wants to build a house for their child. It's people trying to make money.
No, what I'm talking, we'll get into that more later. I think there's a way to do this without creating new problems.
So Trish, what's unique about this, you know, as we've talked about it, is the flag lot situation. I mean, if it were a lot that wasn't a flag lot, the parameters for building an extra house or two on one's lot are different up to a certain point.
That's right.
I mean, they're permitted up to, depending on size and all that, I know, but there's a certain level of which they're allowed to permit. The problem here that we're trying to address is this idea of using the flag lot to get to the other building spots.
Right. It changes the layout along the street, the pattern of development, the access issues.
I just wanted a clarification on it. It's mentioned that that if they're not actually going to develop it, but they're seeking just the division of a lot, then it's relatively simple. Does that imply that if they're trying to combine the development along with the division of the lot, that it can be more complicated?
Yes, I mean, that's definitely the case, because then the question of impervious surface and stormwater management and all of those things come into play at that point. But
stagger it, I guess, divide it, and then.
Well, there is the option of doing that. I mean, in these small situations, I mean, or the likelihood that it fits with what's being proposed, that they don't, you know, reach some point where they're, you know, there has to be, there's no question there has to be a road, for example, that's going to have to be built to some standard and therefore is going to have impervious surface associated with it and stormwater management. So so in the case of small developments, you know, you can subdivide the property and then address those other ordinance provisions at the time you build on the lot. So you still have to consider how much impervious surface is going in there, whether or not stormwater management has to be done or whatever, but that can be done at the time you build, not at the time the subdivision.
But that's true today, isn't it?
Yes, that is the case now.
Okay. Got it. So some of this is a timing issue.
I mean, in a way, it's mostly a timing issue. Thinking back to when I worked for Empowerment Inc., we would do exempt subdivisions with some frequency, and I would say the typical review time for an exempt subdivision, this is like 8 years ago, but it's probably about the same now, was in the, you know, between 1 and 3 weeks, depending on whether, you know, if I got it all right, the first time would be 1 week, and if I had to make a few changes, it might be more like three, but it's short. One month construction interest payment, you know, versus
three. Okay.
Or four or six or, you know.
Okay.
Well, maybe it would be appropriate to hear from the public at our public hearing. Now, the first person signed up is Greg DeWitt.
Thanks, Trish.
Sure. You're welcome. Thank you.
My name is Greg DeWitt. I'm a local attorney here in downtown Carrboro, and I am here as an advocate as well as a local business owner, so just for disclosure purposes. I want to start off with saying that myself and my client are opposed to this text amendment. We feel that it's not the right choice at this time. And as a downtown business owner, I'm also concerned that by approving this amendment, we're going to reduce the density in the downtown area, which is against what Carrboro is, my understanding is Carrboro wants to see more downtown development, more density in the downtown with more walkability, and we feel that this will drive the cost up and increase will reduce the amount of density in the downtown. My main concern is those landowners who do have these slots that could be made into flag lots, and I'm talking primarily about the ones that normally would fall under the exempt process for exempt subdivisions. My concern is we're going to go from, like you said, 1 to 3 weeks at a cost of probably about $700 to $1,000 to do the survey work, plats, fees, to potentially $4,000 to $5,000 to go through the whole Board of Adjustment process. We're creating an extra bureaucracy that doesn't need to happen, doesn't need to happen, and I think it's not appropriate for us to approve this text amendment because of the additional cost. And that's the primary reason why we're opposed to it. Also, I think the North Carolina legislature, when they passed the exemption process, which was the under 160A-376A-4, which creates the idea of an exempt subdivision, their intent was not to have to go through additional process to subdivide these smaller lots that fit under this criteria. And I think this town is basically, if it adopts this amendment, will be kind of going against what the legislature intended at that time. I want to again reiterate that we are opposed to this text amendment. And in the alternative, we ask that you kick it back to planning and say, what's the impact going to be on local businesses and the landowners who would normally fit under the exemption process? Ideally, if they are going to make this text amendment, they should have said things that fall under the exempt subdivision, those flag lots, we'll continue to keep them exempt and not put under this land use ordinance. Any questions?
Please do.
What do you consider to be the downtown? Because as I understand the ordinance, it will apply to
all of Carrboro. So
that's my understanding as well. I'm more concerned about the downtown area because that's where my clients' properties are located, as well as I'm also located downtown. And I know a lot of the local business owners, are located downtown too.
And this applies to residential, if I understand it, not commercial.
Correct, but it's the walkability issue. It's being able to walk to that area.
Number of customers.
Number of customers.
I understand that.
The other thing is that this isn't necessarily against density. It just adds a step for accountability for public to participate.
And I agree with that. My concern is adding additional cost to the landowners when it's unnecessary.
Okay. But it's not contrary to our goal of increasing.
That's right. It's just an additional cost. And, of course, as cost goes up, fewer people who are going to do it.
Thanks, Ray.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. Mayor, can I just comment just for clarification?
Yes,
that,
sir.
That it's not just a timing issue. I mean, the amendment would allow someone to seek flag lots of some of the patterns that you have seen there. That doesn't necessarily mean they're going to get them. In other words, under the current flag lot exemption, you can have those stacked driveways, bing, 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 and then another one right next to that, and another bing, bing, bing right next to that. And presumably, some of the examples that you saw there, if they had to go to the Board of Adjustment, the Board of Adjustment might say, we find that to be inconsistent with public health and safety. You can divide your property into the same number of lots, but you've got to do it with a different way. You couldn't use an exempt procedure, and so it would. I guess the point being, this amendment does not preclude all flag lots, but it also gives an opportunity to review where there are circumstances where flag lots would be considered not appropriate or not consistent with good planning or sound public safety, again, with the repetitive driveways, especially on main highways. So it's not just a function of, well, everybody can do the same thing, it's just going to add an additional process.
That's a good point. Lee Elrod.
This is not really addressing my opinions on the ordinance because I'm here to learn about it. And I just wanted to say that Marty, whom I have not had a chance to meet, hi, did call me this afternoon because apparently you have two petitions in for lots currently in the system under the existing ordinance. And the legal department has written in a paragraph exempting people who are already in the process from the ordinance should be passed this evening, and I appreciate that, and I appreciate being notified of this process and being able to sit in and learn about it.
Are you one of the people who's currently applying? Is that what you're saying?
I'm one of the two people who have applications.
I gotcha.
In.
Okay.
So I just appreciate that process.
All right.
Let me also say again for clarification, I had drafted some language, but and then there's another memo that I hadn't seen before I got here this evening by Mr. Greenstreet, which points out a question about an ambiguity as to the extent to which this does what it was intended to do, to exempt all pre-existing flag lots. And I realize I think he makes a good point, and my suggestion would be that if you ultimately conclude that you want to go forward with this amendment, that it be brought back to you at the next meeting, perhaps on the consent agenda, or however you want to handle it, but that the language that I've got in here, it needs to be tweaked with respect to make it extremely clear that it does not affect pre-existing flag lots, however created, or those flag lots for which applications are correct. Pending at the time of the effective date. I attempted and thought I had that accomplished. The things that have been brought to my attention make it clear that it needs a little bit of work to make it very clear that it does not apply to that. So I don't think the ordinance is quite ready for adoption, even if you should decide that it's the way you want to go. So if you decide it's not the way you want to go, then I won't do that work. If you decide it is the way that you want it to go, then I would suggest giving you the chance to revise that, just that portion of that language, and bring it back for final adoption.
Right. Okay. Thanks. Ken Gorfkel.
Hello. This is actually a little bit of news to me about the exemption for pending applications, but I'm going to read some prepared comments anyway. As you know, I was here before you a month ago concerning an application for flag lots that I had submitted to the Planning Department in mid-October of this year, and you granted me 30 days to complete my application process, which is normally a 2 to 3 week period. I didn't hear anything officially from Planning until about a week ago, when I was told that my application could not be approved in its current form, and then yesterday I was informed of new requirements for approval of my application, which will once again lengthen its approval time. Now, if this text amendment is passed, my application could be denied. I spent over $30,000 during the last year to proceed under the existing ordinance, and throughout that period, I have kept Planning staff informed. Since I've already invested substantial time and money in my project based on the ordinances currently in force, I would ask you to allow me to complete the application process conforming to all of Planning's new requirements, but exempt from the provisions of the text amendment if it's passed. Otherwise, the City of Carrboro will have extended my application period and then used that extension of time to pass a law giving them the ability to deny my application, and that doesn't seem fair. I'm not a big national developer with deep pockets, and this would be a real financial blow for me. Also, in my opinion, it would be a loss to the City of Carrboro, since my aim has always been to create infill lots, which would allow for houses to be built at reasonable prices, good for sustainability, affordability, walkability, as well as for the town's tax base, as Mr. DeWitt has already mentioned. With regard to the text amendment itself, I strongly oppose it. It will hurt other homeowners and small developers like me by forcing them to spend substantial amounts of time and money simply to do a 2 or 3 lot subdivision. And in my meeting with staff yesterday, I specifically asked them how long this SUP process would take, and they said it could be between 2 and 4 months, but then they also told me that it might be 6 months or 8 months or even 10 months. As I understand it, the amendment will make the homeowner who wishes to create 1 or 2 flag lots spend between 6 months and a year of time, make his project subject to the whims of his neighbors, as well as arbitrary decisions on the part of the Planning Department, the Planning Advisory Board, and the Board of Adjustment, and force him to spend a substantial amount of money to go through the process with no guarantee of success. Flag lots are the primary source of infill lots. Thus, as a result of this amendment, not only will many homeowners simply choose not to go ahead with subdivision and lose much of the potential value of their property, but also the city will lose the potential for creation of infill lots, which are part, as I understand it, of their own vision for the downtown area. Finally, I have to say that I myself did not understand the full implications of this text amendment until yesterday in my meeting with the planning staff. And that, for me, brings up the question of notice. The only notice that I could find was in the Chapel Hill Herald, in which on November 12th and November 19th appeared, and I quote, "Amendments to text of Carborough Land Use Ordinance," unquote. That was in reference to this matter. I also checked with Orange County, and they gave me a huge number, over 3,000 lots that are 15,000 feet or greater with the potential for subdivision. So I wonder whether it really is only affecting the 40 lots that Trish was talking about. And I would like to see more information on that. But regardless, if this text amendment is passed, many property owners could potentially lose their ability to create these one or two additional lots, which would reduce their property's value substantially. And at the very least, it seems to me that these property owners should receive a letter about informing them of this text amendment. I am sure that from a legal standpoint, the city of Carborough gave proper notice. However, this text amendment, as it is written, has so much power, it affects all these properties, and it could cause so much financial loss to Carborough property owners that I believe far more notice should be given than just a one-liner buried in the Chapel Hill Herald. Any questions?
Thanks, Ken. Tom Wilber.
Well, I want to make a comment while he's coming up, which sure. is I really am kind of, I want to object to the characterization of citizen input on this as whimsical. And I think this board, and I think I'm speaking accurately for us all, we take the input of every citizen very seriously and consider it a legitimate concern. And we may not always agree with every citizen, but we would never characterize a citizen's concern as whimsical. And to characterize the advice we get from our advisory boards as arbitrary is just wrong. Our advisory board members work really hard, and they put a lot of thought and time into the recommendations they give this board, and they help us. They help the town a lot. So I just want to make sure that it's clear that those characterizations in no way represent what this board thinks, and that it's not really, I would hope that citizens would have a better understanding of how we look at community input in Carborough and how we rely on the thoughtful recommendations of our advisory boards.
Mr. Wilper.
Thanks. My name is Tom Wilper. I'm a property owner in Carborough, realtor. I've also served on the Appearance Commission for several years, so I'm somewhat familiar with the planning approvals process in town. I want to just mention that I read Glenn Greenstreet's letter that was submitted to the board, I think yesterday or today, and I thought it raised some really excellent issues and problems with the ordinance the way it's written. It also seems that during the meeting we've figured out a couple edits to the ordinance that, you know, even staff has raised that need to be changed and edited so that what we're looking at tonight isn't something that's sort of fully baked, and therefore I would encourage you to at least continue and not vote tonight on it, but also just to consider all the public comments that have been made. I oppose the text amendment for three primary reasons. Number one, it goes against stated goals and objectives of the town of Carborough, and this is a little redundant from what other people have said, but I don't see how it enables infill. Granted, there's a process that's being implemented when a flag lot is created. for public input, so it's not anti-infill, but it's not enabling infill either. It's not enabling sustainability, walkability. It's not enabling the creation of more affordable housing. Smaller lots allow builders and people to put less expensive homes on those lots because land has value and structures have value, and when the lot is big, it can drive up the cost of a house. How does it improve the tax base? I don't see that in the justification or the staff presentation. Why would we change an ordinance in a way that is counter those goals? Instead, what I heard was, let's make a simple process of splitting one parcel into two or three, including a flag lot, more involved, more difficult, more expensive, and subject to more scrutiny. It's a deterrent. The SUP process is a deterrent. To speculate, as the staff narrative attached to the amendment does, that during the review process, quote, the scope and number of comments should remain narrow and relatively few, and to say that the extent of applicable requirements is expected to remain limited is exactly that. It's speculative. We don't know what people will say. We have no idea once a candidate, you know, or an applicant enters the SUP process, what the public will say, what the Board of Adjustment will say, what they'll send them out to advisory boards to hear, what they'll require. You know, in some cases, they could be required to, you know, comply with things like, you know, 40% open space just for creating two lots. It just doesn't make a lot of sense. Carbo's done a very good job over the years of scaring off many developers because of its challenging, unpredictable, and expensive approvals process. With this change, we may even square off citizens and small property owners. The board and staff should be considering ways to enable and encourage infill, not deter it. Small lots in town are good, not bad. They add character, keep house prices more affordable, reasonable, enable walkability, and provide more opportunities for people to own their homes. If driveways and access are the problem, let's look at driveway and signage requirements, not just take flag lot creation and subject it to the SUP process. Number two is, I don't think we fully yet realize the impact and ramifications of the text amendment. I don't think people in Carbo have had time to research and digest it, especially since a major rewrite was released as recently as Friday. Have we really identified every lot in town in which a flag lot could be created? The map appears to, but remember the map had shaded lots, of which there were 40, that just don't have buildings on them, but that doesn't mean that someone who has a house at the front of a two-acre lot isn't going to be impacted by this text amendment. Those are people that have done it on Maple Avenue, Hillcrest, Hillsboro, all over town. Number three is, I don't think it's fair to require the same or similar approvals process for the creation of two lots from one as is required of a major subdivision and a large developer. I'm thinking here about Jim and Mary, homeowner who live in Carbro in a large lot that's eligible for subdividing, and are thinking that when it's time to send their daughter off to college in 5 years, they'll split off their lot and sell off the flag lot and back. Won't they be surprised to find out they may have to hire an attorney, a land planner, notify neighbors within 500 feet, hold a neighborhood meeting, present at a Board of Adjustment meeting and a public hearing, and obtain feedback from advisory boards and many other people? It might just make them avoid doing it. Instead, they may just sell their house with the huge backyard for a nice high price, move out of town so that they can pay their daughter's college tuition from their property tax savings. Even though staff minimized that the new flag lot SUP process will not involve certain plan review steps, they go on to state that compliance with other LUO sections such as parking, recreational facilities, and open space, stormwater review, et cetera, will be demonstrated where applicable during review of an application to actually build on the lots. The issue here is that someone can subdivide their property as long as they tell staff that they don't have any immediate plans to develop on it. Some people create those flag lots to sell them, in the example I just did, to make revenue to put their daughter through college or do whatever else. And what's going to happen is when they convey that lot, it's going to come with a whole list of restrictions on the buyer's ability to develop it. And that's going to lower the property's value and make it more challenging and cost prohibitive to put a structure or two or three on that lot. I contacted many people about this ordinance change because I don't agree that it's a good thing for Carbro. I thought it was important for me to inform people who might be affected and might not have seen the public notice that Mr. Gorfkel mentioned in the Herald. I have a small list attached to the printout I gave of six people that sent me emails saying that they strongly oppose the text amendment that would limit or make the creation of flag lots more challenging. I received a few anecdotal comments. Specifically, one said that it will negatively affect land values in Carborough and ultimately increase urban sprawl by decreasing infill development. Again, I strongly encourage you to oppose the amendment. Thank you for your time.
Thanks.
Thanks.
And then the last person I have signed up is Glenn Greenstreet.
Good evening. Thank you for letting me speak before you this evening. My head is spinning a little bit because I have a lot of different ideas and thoughts about some of these questions and topics that are going back and forth across the room. I guess I do have an appreciation from a public policy point of view that you're trying to build a construct that is respectful of the public interest in all of these steps in the development process and outcomes in individual neighbors and for individual citizens. That notwithstanding, I still have some concerns about the way this is being handled. I'm confused about whether we're talking about a problem with flaglots or whether we're talking about a problem with exempt subdivisions. And I won't agree or disagree with your opinion on either of those topics, but putting them together is making this very confusing. You know, when you stand on a property and look at a driveway, there are no lines drawn across the lawn. So the idea that somehow de facto a driveway on a flag lot is less functional than a driveway on an otherwise more conventional lot is a premise that I don't think has been tested in this discussion. I think we've just labeled flag lots as somehow being a design issue. And I don't see anything in the text amendment or in the ordinance that talks about what the standard is for what is a good driveway or not a good driveway. I believe it's just a generic description that the access shall be appropriate and suitable for the purpose that it's intended. And I don't think that gives us any guidelines to decide what is or isn't an appropriate driveway for a flaglot configuration. I see that as problematic for an applicant, but I also see that as a big political challenge, because if you're going to initiate a public review process, especially focused on a flaglot, and the presumption is that at least one of the issues with the flaglot is the acceptability or unacceptability of the driveway, when you bring public comment, that's going to be the focus of a lot of the discussion. Now, I might be a neighbor and I might actually be concerned about something else, but if I'm going to participate in the process and try to influence the outcome, I'm going to want to come talk to you about whether or not I think that driveway is safe. Meanwhile, the applicant is going to be trying to somehow justify that the driveway is safe. But who's right, who's wrong? In the meantime, you've got your Board of Adjustments sitting there wrestling with, you know, are they voting on a referendum about whether or not they support infill development? Are they looking at some other aspect of this project that they do or don't like, but they don't necessarily have a foothold to vote based on that, so they're going to vote based on their opinion on the driveway? It becomes a political discussion instead of an engineering design discussion. I do appreciate the concern about public notice. I've built on about five parcels in Carborough, and in those processes, I have used a combination of exempt subdivisions or a use by right to build between one and four single-family homes on an undivided parcel. And I've always felt the need to sort of tread lightly in the situation of taking it upon myself that when I'm essentially building within my own self-styled subdivision, that I have to meet certain criteria to protect my own interests, and that I have to meet certain criteria to meet the interests of, in my case, my clients, because these are For me, these are predominantly rental houses. But I did want to point out to you that, in my experience, the spirit and the end product of the use by right of building 1 to 4 single-family homes on an undivided parcel is very similar to the results that you're seeing from an exempt subdivision. So when you go after the exempt subdivision as being sort of an infection, shall we say, and you're trying to sort of create a structure but by which you can either limit or control exempt subdivisions, you're also going after some of your own culture of how, in the past at least, the community has moderated and encouraged some infill development in your neighborhoods. So I'll leave it up to you to decide where the balance is between public notice versus incentivizing that type of infill. But just saying that the exempt subdivision is the foreign antibody that you need to go after and get rid of, I think, is a mistake, because I think what you're ending up doing, and I think where we're at now, is you're sending ripples through some of your own policies and creating some, if not contradictions, at least challenges to navigate through the process. I did write a letter to y'all. I hope you received it. I'm sorry I didn't get it to you sooner. I had several points I wanted to make, and I spent some time thinking about it. I'm not going to go through the whole list item by item, but
thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. But I did want to ask for a little more attention. I think the previous speaker made the same comment. Staff has described a policy of a difference between an application for subdivision and an application for development, and I take that at face value. That's the first time that I've heard that description, so I don't know the details of what their policy is, but I will tell you my experience is that that is an interpretation. It is not written into the ordinance what the definition is between subdivision and what the difference is between development. So I don't understand, for instance, if a person is creating a flag lot development and there is a sidewalk requirement or some such thing, my understanding would be that that plat cannot be recorded until that sidewalk is built. So at what point does activity on that property activate the development restrictions as opposed to the subdivision standards? And I'm still confused about if you subdivide a property and therefore it's not considered a development, and therefore the open space and the recreation space and so forth are not being considered at that point in time, then at what point in time are those considered? Because I have brought to staff hypotheticals to build more than one home on an undivided property, and I know in that scenario that those are treated as development applications and that open space and recreation space is a requirement. So I don't understand how, if somebody's dividing a half-acre lot into 2/4 acres, at what point in time, under either the existing ordinance or this ordinance as amended, as proposed, those issues kick in. I do know that for an exempt subdivision, the open space requirement and the recreation space requirement are not applied because those are Carborough standards and they don't apply under the exempt subdivision. I do know that stormwater requirements, school impact fees, driveway permits, all those types of things are triggered by the building permit application. So it's not, for those items, it's not relevant whether they're triggered by a development review or by a building permit application. Those things will happen before a house is built on property. But I think for you to consider the burden that's being placed by moving something from an exempt category to a CUP or an SUP, you need enough information to understand when under what circumstances those requirements are going to have to be met, because I don't think you can realistically say that a 2 or 3 lot subdivision is going to meet those requirements. Thank you.
Thank you, Glenn.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else here who has not signed up who would like to speak on this matter? Okay.
I think we're at a point we're going to have to continue it, because I want more information. normally I'm a little more pushier for something that I like. And I'm not saying that I just like the content, but I think we need more information.
I'm going to speak as a citizen and a homeowner and a spouse of a builder and distance myself a little bit from my role as an alderman. I live in a house on a flag lot on Maple Avenue. There are at least five, maybe six flag lot houses in my neighborhood, if you include Maple and some that come off of Greensboro. Actually, there are eight. These are one house built in somebody's backyard. We went to the appearance commission. They go to the appearance commission. We would not have been able to afford to build our house under this. You know, we don't have a lot of money. We would not have been able to afford this process or the time that added to it, and neither would some of my neighbors. And speaking very personally, as the spouse of a builder who has built many of these infill things in a time when everybody in the building community is looking for their next job, anything that would delay the process for single family, not a big development, but one house on a new lot, that's going to hurt the smallest of the builders. And I'll admit, I'm speaking very, very personally. I think there are some problems, and there have been some mistakes, and there have been some things that the whole community doesn't like that have given rise to this. I think this is too large of a tool to be using. There needs to be a way to get rid of the bad stuff without hurting the good stuff, and particularly without hurting the smallest people. I mean, there's no way James and I, we sat down and took this apart, and there's no way we could have afforded to build our house and go through like a 4 to 6 month process, hire lawyers, pay for public hearings. I mean, we just couldn't have afforded to do it, and I don't think other people could have either. And you have a lot of people in our position. You have a lot of small builders in our position. You also have, as Tom was talking about, you have people, and I'm very specifically talking the two lot subdivisions. You have a lot of people who are planning on, we'll sell this back lot. I know people who are looking for people to buy their back lot so that they can make enough money to stay in their house or to send their kids to college. And this would hurt the smallest people, the most vulnerable people, if it goes down to that level. And I know the problems we're trying to fix. And this would not only fix those, it would hurt a lot of us. And I'll just, you know, I'm up front. It would hurt us, and so I may even recuse myself. But James isn't working on anything now that's affected by this. I'll put that out there. He's not. But we know a lot of people who are. We know people who own lots. It's too fine. It goes down too far. So that is my, if I was up behind that microphone, that's what I would be saying.
So Jackie, would you want to continue to exempt the one lot situation like that you were describing, where it's, you know, one property owner with a single back lot, like yours is?
Yeah, or maybe two. I mean, I think we, you know, we would need to think about that, but definitely one extra lot I think should be exempt. And you do go through, you know, because of the area we live in, it's not the historic district, but we did have to go before the appearance commission, and so have the other houses that he's built. And it's not just us I'm worried about. It's all the people that go into building these houses. It's hard enough now. So I think we need to there needs to be, there's a difference between one or two extra houses, if done right, and 12, you know? So anyhow, that's my public citizen's comment.
I'm going to make a public citizen's comment. My public citizen's comment is, when you look at the whole thing, and I'm a proponent of infill, but we have this sort of, in Carborough, to me, sort of schizophrenic. Well, we want a lot of development in certain places, and yet we don't want a lot of development in other places where it may be more appropriately planned when you have just one large piece of property as opposed to placing it in a existing neighborhood. And that puts pressure on both the people who live in older homes who don't have homeowners associations. So there are no limits. There aren't going to be that many changes unless something catastrophic happens in certain neighborhoods developed with homeowners associations, because you have all that legal stuff on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And so that puts more pressure on existing neighborhoods that don't have homeowners associations. And we see it. And, you know, there has to be some sort of balance so that those individuals and those existing neighborhoods who come together as a neighborhood and have been neighbors longer and don't require to come and meet every year and vote on certain things and have an appearance commission internally to say, look, I need to be able to at least have some input on what's going to go around me.
I know the situations you're referring to, and I think they need to be addressed too. I think we need to do some very fine tuning here.
Yeah. Well, I'll make a couple comments as a member of the Board of Aldermen. And I know the last gentleman who spoke, I think he sent us an email we got late today that looked really good and long and full of a lot of information, but I didn't have time to look it over. But one of the points he raised in his comments struck me, that when we look at, and this kind of gets to this policy problem, I think, that we're dealing with, how do we justify a differentiation between, you know, our exempt subdivisions and our right to build, I guess that's the term you use, the right to build subdivision. You know, when here, what when I asked Trish, you know, about the difference here is with flaglots, what kicks it in is the access, the long, skinny driveway. It's the access. But some of the other problems that we're talking about, neighbors' concerns and so on or whatever, I mean, those are problems anytime someone builds on their property. And so he also spoke to a little bit of the ambiguity as to what makes the driveway reasonable or not. And the Planning Board actually brought that up in their comments, that the standard, you know, maybe the standard, if that's the standard that we're looking at, maybe that's a standard that needs to be addressed at the staff level, not necessarily a full-blown, you know, hearing before the Board of Adjustment or whatever. So anyway, point being, a lot of good comments I think were raised tonight, and particularly during those comments.
We'll just proceed down the table.
Well, I feel like we're trying to resolve an issue with these tools that are not weren't intended to resolve this issue, and the main issue is that, you know, it's costly to run an OWASA line to a new building on an existing property, and for that reason we have to create these flag lots, and we can't share a line that runs from a main with the existing house without going through this other process of a undivided property. So I'm wondering how difficult it might be in recognition of this issue to create something specific that could be a hybrid that would just, I mean, would it entail, would we have to involve OWASA, or can there be something where we could say it's okay for one house to share a water line run from an OWASA main under certain circumstances?
You'd have to involve OWASA.
It wouldn't be excited to hear about that. The problem is, as a practical matter, the problem is, you know, when you share sewer lines, that when the sewer line gets stopped up, you know, who's responsible and for dealing with it and things like that. We actually have some situations in downtown Carborough where two different existing buildings with two different owners who don't get along with each other have a shared sewer line. And it
can get stinky. but I agree with your basic point, which is maybe there's some middle ground here somewhere, but well, or some other solution.
Intake, maybe it's an opportunity to promote human manure.
No. Sorry. No.
Dan.
I'm wanting to kind of interrogate this point about the time frame all this review is going to take, because when Trish was up here, she said 2 to 4 months, and then we've heard several people insisting that really that means 6 months or even longer. And I guess, I mean, I'm pretty sure we're not going to approve this tonight. We're, you know, at most going to get some revisions and more information, but I would like some more specificity if this comes back to us on that time frame, particularly on advisory board review, because it doesn't seem to me that there needs to be a whole lot of advisory board review on this. Like, I can think of almost all the advisory boards that don't need to review something like this, and maybe one or two do. You know, I would like more information on that, because, you know, when I think about the cost, I don't see as that $300 application fee is not going to make or break anyone doing a project. But if it's a question of holding, a debt on a piece of land for 6 months, then that could be significant, perhaps even at today's interest rates. So I think if there's a way that we can have some certainty as to a shorter period of review time, that's going to potentially address some of the concerns about this.
And Dan, to your point, along with the timeline, the cost, Trish, because we talked about the 300, but I've heard other folks talking about it could be upwards of thousands of dollars. And what cost is there extra involved in this that they wouldn't have to absorb anyway with permitting a new house anyway?
And could we have it? Let me make a suggestion, easier to understand. Existing costs in one column, proposed text and the costs on the other. And that makes it so people can look and
make
say,
a comparison side by side.
And are you thinking not just cost to the town, but potential costs of actually preparing the application?
Right. Costs
or whatever.
And whether they, people usually get lawyers, but also.
Just the cost.
Well, there's the cost, and it adds to the cost of housing.
Well, someone already hired a lawyer to come to the hearing tonight, so there you go.
Anyway, I would also like to see if it would be possible to come up with something that would differentiate between one house and more, would maybe isolate just one house, because that's a different.
I want to add another thing into that mix, and maybe I'm misapprehending something, or maybe there's something that already addresses this. I don't know, but it struck me as we were talking that there are actually a lot of I can think of a number of places around town where properties already have 2 dwelling units on them on one lot, and where the zoning ordinance would allow the person who owns that to divide it into 2, and it would probably have to, in most cases, such situations would almost have to involve a flag lot because it's typically one house behind another. I'm not inclined to vote in favor of this whole thing, but if I were going to be able to vote for some revised version of it, I think it would have to draw a distinction there. And I guess what I'm trying to suggest is something along the lines that, the provisions would not apply in a situation where, prior to effective date of this ordinance, there were already existing dwellings, and the subdivision, effectively isn't a development application because there's no additional development that's actually proposed. It's just a matter of
separating
the ownership of two existing houses. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Okay.
Seems like that's a pretty different, you know, the public's the sort of neighbors and public's interest in that is greatly reduced, I should think. So I would just, you don't have to respond to that now, but if we could take a look into that issue for when this comes back. And then the other thing is, I know we sometimes wind up in the situation, and this actually happened when I built my house. My house would not be a flag lot under the definition of this ordinance because I've got a lot of street frontage on Ash Street. But it happens that there's no sewer line in Ash Street. So when we configured our lot, we made a little flag, not for our driveway, but for our sewer line that goes to Poplar Avenue where there is a sewer. Would the way you have this structured now, I guess my question is, I can think of there are two really cute houses on Pine Hill Drive that are the same way, where the driveway comes out on a public street. It has a regular sort of lot width at the street, but the sewer, there's a little sewer line snaking all over the place to get out to Main Street because the sewer line, at least at that time, didn't exist in Pine Hill Drive. Does this prevent? I'm trying to understand whether the definition of flag lot here is going to sort of cause a problem for that type of lot development. Do you see what I'm getting at? Maybe you can respond to that question next time.
Or if it does, not exempt it from having that problem.
Yeah, anyway, just right. Let's just future clarification about that issue would be helpful. And then I guess the last thing is that I would say is, you know, notwithstanding what staff, thank you, by the way, for following up on being in contact with affordable housing developers on this question. I disagree somewhat. I disagree considerably, actually, with what some of them were saying, that this would not necessarily be a major new burden. And I know the public, has a right to have an interest in what's happening in adjacent properties or what's happening in their community in terms of these subdivisions and developments. But you know, I think I mentioned before that we did a lot of work with OPC Foundation for Mental Health in developing affordable housing, and we purposely went after exempt subdivision rules. We purposely used flag lot rules and exempt subdivision rules together to do a three-unit development for OPC's clients because we knew what a disaster a public hearing would look like, because we didn't want to have a public hearing.
But, you know, I'm going to just say this. Not that I'm opposed to that, because I think there needs to be more of them. But the problem is they're always placed where you can have that exception. You couldn't put one in Hogan's Falls, could you?
No, because further subdivision.
And my point is you have a group of the town that absorbs that, not just saying mental health, but infield. At a cost, when people talk about developing large tracts of property, and they're talking about it infield that's probably better controlled than it is in some respects sometimes when you put it in an existing neighborhood. And I think we need to talk about that and balance that out.
That is an interesting point.
I know this
obviously that's kind of somewhat separate from this, but
it plays a part.
Yes.
It does play a part. It plays a part.
Yes.
And I'm going to bring it up all the time.
Sorry, I'm trying to organize my thoughts here. That's okay. I guess the Board of Aldermen appointed me to the Board of Adjustment maybe a year or two before I was elected to the Board of Aldermen, so mm-hmm. I've been involved in Carborough Town Government for coming up close to 10 years now. And in that 10 years, the infill, the small infill development controversy that came up that was most acrimonious and most difficult to deal with was some infill development that happened on Pine Street.
Yes, I do.
I'll just point out, none of that was an exempt subdivision. None of that has a flag, was a flag lot or is a flag lot. All of it had to do with something else entirely, which was actually development of multiple dwelling units on one lot.
With rental property with young people who didn't respect their neighbors.
And absolutely. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, a landlord who didn't care.
That's exactly right.
Or worse than didn't care. But point I'm trying to get at is that was, and to some degree still is, a problem.
Yes, it is.
This is a solution, but is not a solution to that problem.
Right.
I think it's actually difficult to articulate what problem this is a solution to, other than, you know, second-guessing J.T. Lewis's taste in development. Or, you know, I mean, I just feel like...
more legitimate access issues of some sort. Right. You know, some kind of way that, you know, that's
what I see, just some kind of legitimate access issue of some sort that maybe could be reviewed in some other way.
Yeah, well, and I mean... You do, even when you do an exempt subdivision, you know, you do still have to show that you have access to the street. That is a requirement in the ordinance. So, I mean, it's not, you know. Maybe what we should be looking at is the question of whether it's appropriate to, you know, we have a rule in Carborough that that is also implicated in these situations we haven't talked about very much, but there's a limit of 3 dwelling units per driveway. You can't have 4 dwelling units on one shared driveway. maybe that's a question that we ought to, maybe we ought to be second guessing that rule.
Right.
I'm not saying we should, but I'm just saying.
Mm-hmm. Well,
some of these problems seem like they relate more to that than that rule than they do to this.
Well, you could do that if you had a standard, as the gentleman said, about what a specific number related standard that would say, okay, in these situations X, you have to have this kind of driveway, and in these other situations you have to have Y, this kind of driveway.
I have one more thing to say, but I'll let you all keep responding. Dan first and Sammy.
Well, no, you finish what you have to say and then I'll go.
It's a whole different
Well, I have two things. One is that I want to concur with Joel that, like, in my neighborhood, I think the HOA has, like, too much control over what people can do. But I wouldn't want there to be, and I don't know that it needs to be through an HOA. I'd rather it be through a public process that certain things were limited, because the HOA is not really democratic. So I think, you know, the opportunity for people to have a democratic and public process to have some influence over the fate of their neighborhoods is important. It doesn't mean that anyone's ideas are binding on anyone else. I just think I agree that that's important. My other, I guess, question mark is whether we're at a juncture where we should make sure there are at least 3 of us who want to continue working on this, because if there aren't, then, you know, either we should get into some of the discussions of other options or mm-hmm. You know, just to be clear on that point, and I say at least 3 because, you know, Randy's not here, right?
I like the idea of other options, and I like the idea of the driveways and how many houses can share a driveway, and to get around the issue of connecting to an Owosso main. I mean, why is it that we have to have these flag sticks be the width of roads? Can they be as thin as pipes?
No, because you have to put the pipe at a certain level down, and then you have to be able for safety when you have to dig up the pipe and it's not working. To dig up the pipe without having the hole that you have people in fall on them.
But it doesn't have to be the width of a road.
Well, but you have to get a backhoe in there to do the digging.
There's just not people just.
Owosso has the standard that's 10 feet.
Yeah.
But I.
It's Owosso standard.
Yeah.
It's, you know, that I'm not saying we couldn't have a discussion about that number.
But other can options.
That is
the
change
other
it?
Options is, I mean, your main point, right?
But other options, yeah. But I mean, maybe even engaging with Owosso and having them, you know,
could be worthy of
see the light
discussion. Well, they might help us see the light too, because I think there's good reasons for some of their policies.
But
it'd be interesting to have that conversation.
For example, for sure. Those lots that have four contiguous driveways, their requirement of a 10-foot wide is more than fulfilled. So, it's, you know, there's no reason to add 10 plus 10 plus 10 plus 10. So there's ways around that, I think.
Can I make one other comment?
Yeah.
Which is on this point of, like, whether this is going to, like, interfere with someone's creativity or something like that. And not that it's a good comparison, but I'm willing to hazard a bet that Omar would come up here and testify that when he brings his plans in for review and hears public comment and advisory board review, that the result is a better plan than they started with. And, you know, that there's actually value in getting that insight. So I don't think we should look at that in terms of, you know, what a property owner wants to build or what they want to do, as, you know, the public scrutiny is entirely a burden on them. I think there's also benefits to that. But I don't think that's a huge point in this discussion.
Right. I think the last point that I wanted to make, and I realize that it might be kind of dangerous territory, but you know, speaking as the only person who's ever been an elected official in both Carrboro and Chapel Hill.
So you got it right the second time.
I did. And what I was going to remark on is what one of the joys of being an elected official in Carrboro is that I think the community as a whole has a different kind of tenor of approach toward development, and especially small scale development, but even large scale development, I think. Well, we can debate that another time. It's not relevant tonight whether it's true about that. But you know, I think well, Chapel Hill took the step years and years ago of completely prohibiting flaglots. You're not allowed to develop a flaglot under virtually any circumstances in Chapel Hill. You're not allowed to lease out your property to more than three unrelated individuals in Chapel Hill. No more than three unrelated individuals in one house. And now, as of 8 or so years ago in Chapel Hill, every subdivision has to at least go to the planning board, which is effectively in Chapel Hill. They use their planning board the way they do. The planning board in Chapel Hill does a lot of the functions that the Board of Adjustment does in Carrboro. So when I say it has to go to planning board, I mean for consideration for approval, as we send things sometimes to the Board of Adjustment. Every subdivision has to go either to the planning board or to the Chapel Hill Town Council, even creating just one new lot. Even exactly the situation you were getting at earlier, and I guess all I'm trying to say is, I don't want to go down any of those roads. Really, I just feel like all of that is just too fussy for Carrboro, and it's probably right for Chapel Hill. That's fine, but I don't feel like we need to get into that level of trying to control everything that happens. That's just a sort of generalized concern about the direction of.
I agree with you, but I'm going to have to say there's got to be some board discussion about how we balance. If you're going to say we're going to have a certain amount of intensity in places where it works, and we don't develop a certain amount of intensity somewhere else where we could develop enough intensity such that we could have greater transportation, and greater density. And while these discussions bring that up, we never really have a discussion about that until something that we don't like comes before us. And I think you need to have a broader philosophy and policy about that as we go in, because the truth of the matter is there's an urban service boundary that doesn't go beyond Eubanks Road. And a lot of folk that move out, say, beyond between Homestead and Eubanks Road, mm-hmm. have an expectation that it's going to be pastoral. Well, it can't be pastoral because there are not really any farms left in between that part.
You know, we used to have board retreats where we actually had these philosophical discussions, and they weren't directed. They were, you would talk about this stuff, and you would talk about it for too long, but you would talk about it.
But you would get to the bottom of it, hopefully.
Yeah, you could kind of get to the bottom of it, and it wasn't super structured with a whole lot of presentations. It was, this is what we're going to talk about. And I'd like to suggest that at some point we all do this. You know, we have these conversations in a way where it's a real conversation. It's not just a one da 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 da. Just throw that out there.
Yeah.
And come to my house. I got the wine. We can do it.
I would like to make a request for staff, if it's all right with everyone.
Sure.
Else. Along with the other costs that we were requesting, I'd like to see the alternative of having a WASA actually provide it, you know, through an easement directly to the house as a comparison, for comparison's sake. And then I would also want us to ask a WASA what it would take, letting them understand our situation where we're trying to prevent 4 10-foot-wide driveways side by side, and how to, if there's a way, even though they may have rules that require 10 foot, and if there's a way in which they could recognize that as being extreme and kind of along with our current rules of allowing 3 to 4 people using one driveway, having the same apply for access to water and sewer.
So I'm hearing from what you're suggesting, kind of a pickup on the previous comment. I'm sorry for being rude and interrupting. I'm sorry.
No.
Kind of like on with the previous comment that maybe we don't want to move forward with what's in front of us now, and instead we would like to start moving towards some other solutions to the same problem. Is that what we're hearing here? I don't know whether it was Dan who suggested
that. Question.
Yeah.
I don't think we necessarily have to, I'm not necessarily advocating for completely throwing this idea out, but I think it would be good to explore what other tools and approaches there might be and
fine tune this or,
yeah.
But just,
or make a mix of a couple different approaches or something like that. But,
yeah.
I'll say that I'm not opposed to having an exemption for 1 or 2 houses.
Okay.
When we start leaning
good.
Over to 3 or 4,
right?
I'm not as comfortable with that, and I don't know I could support it.
So that's the kind of thing we need to be fine-tuning.
Well, I guess probably basically also this needs to undergo some community ferment as
which
well.
Which it will, yeah.
So when... Mr. Manager, when would you, wouldn't anticipate bringing this back December 7th, would you? Or would you?
Absolutely not.
They wouldn't know what to bring back.
There's no way.
Right.
Well,
okay, so we don't need to, what's that? Yeah, I don't know that we need to pick any specific date. I just wanted to clarify about that. It'd probably be sometime in January.
Continuing the hearing, do we need to specify?
Oh, I don't know. Mr. Attorney?
No, because you've held really already 2 hearings on it, and so you've satisfied the statutory requirements, unless it gets, you know, substantially changed and comes back in a different form or whatever.
Well, but it kind of seems
it
like
it might. It
kind of seems like it may very well.
I move that this come back to us at the staff's leisure and with
addressing, with a report addressing the various comments board members.
Okay. We can just re-advertise at that time.
And can we maybe, if it's true that it wasn't as descriptive of an announcement, maybe make it more descriptive and attractive, too, on top of descriptive?
The public notice, in terms of describing what it did, was quite descriptive and more detailed than was necessary. I think the concern was that do people see the public notifications?
Yeah.
And there were certainly letters and individual phone calls made to people that we knew that were had a particular interest in it. Mm-hmm. So it got more than the normal
in the Herald
advertisement.
Can we put it in the citizen?
Yeah, although it's the people you need to contact are the folks who don't live in the HOA neighborhoods on this issue. But why don't we I guess the problem with, if we were clearly moving forward with more or less exactly this proposal, then I'd be interested in some of the points that Mr. Gorfkel made about, like, well, if the staff is telling us we know what lots might be affected by this, we could notify them. But at this point, it seems like it's enough up in the air about what the proposal sort of ultimately will be.
Right.
That I don't. It's a little difficult to say what the right level of notice would be, but
we need to talk things through and get some more feedback before we can.
So, I think we should ferment also on the question of what kind of notice to give. All right. So it's been moved that this be referred back to the staff to come back to us sometime in 2011, presumably. Been seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed,
come back, but not the exact thing that they.
Well, right. The respond to the discussion, I guess, is the. Yeah. All right.
Take a break.
All right. We're on a 5-minute recess.
We'll be great.
my children call me.
Like you can answer them.
So this won't be long. This is going to be one of those things where we go through two items in 10 minutes.
I gave some advice to the staff about the presentation for item one. All right. Welcome back. We're back in session. We are on agenda item number one, a public hearing on land use ordinance amendment related to application for stormwater control and various other abbreviations. Is there, I don't have anybody signed up to speak on this. Is there somebody who's here tonight to speak on this item?
I see no one with a burning interest.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. This amendment follows really on your efforts principally to change some procedures, make it real clear that commercial development specifically can hold off on some stormwater engineering review until construction plan approval, things that otherwise would be needed at the permit stage. This follows from a report you had in June, and you directed us at that time to prepare an ordinance that would make that change. And we provided for you the checklist again, which you saw in June, as well as this presentation at your places this evening. We included two other changes in here that are housekeeping changes. One is clarifications about the CLOMAR and the LOMAR process, and that is the conditional letter of map revision, a process that has to go into place when there is a special flood hazard area encroachment on a piece of property. The CLOMAR is the preliminary approval of that change, and it does have to go through an extensive engineering review and approval by FEMA before the work can actually be done. And then the LOMAR is the letter of map revision that follows the actual construction of the change of the impact to the special flood hazard area. And so these changes in the ordinance make that procedure clear. The responsibilities at the different stages of construction permit approval and then construction plan approval. And then the final change in the draft ordinance is a clarification. Our ordinance specifically right now has a required amount of time that the drawdown has to occur in stormwater structures. And it is not right now consistent with the state's BMP manual. We put that provision in place before the current version of the state BMP manual, so we're just out of sync with it. And instead of specifying another standard in here, we're just proposing that language that specifically references the need for these stormwater structures to the water volume to draw down consistent with the BMP manual. And so those are the changes that are in the draft ordinance. And the Planning Board has reviewed this, and Orange County has reviewed this as well, and recommend adoption and found no inconsistency. The staff recommends adoption of the resolution of consistency and the ordinance itself.
Okay. Let me just double check. Is there anyone here to speak on this item? Okay. Are there any questions for staff?
No, I was just going to thank staff for working on this and for trying to ascertain a way to make the process a little bit faster in the early going with regard to some of the required engineering information with regard to drainage and stormwater, and I move the item.
Second.
Then we have to close the public hearing.
Not for a permit approval.
Okay.
It's not a permit.
Okay.
To say, I think. So it's been the ordinance has been moved. And is there a second?
I second.
Who seconded it? All those in favor signify by saying
that was the resolution of consistency.
Resolution of consistency was moved. Excuse me, and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed. Matter passed unanimously.
Move the ordinance.
Second.
Moved and seconded for the ordinance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Matter passed unanimously.
Thanks, Craig.
Item two. Yes, thank you. Item two, continuation of public hearing related to affordable housing.
Okay. This is an item that's been before you almost a year ago. It actually started its public hearing process a year ago tomorrow. And it does follow from a text amendment, an amendment that the Board of Aldermen requested after conversations that Alderman Coleman had with Robert Dowling of the Community Land Trust. The change would is specifically focusing on the sort of the way we define affordability within the ordinance in association. It's specifically defined with it in association with the affordable housing density bonus, and it's that requirement or that provision is referenced in other sections of the land use ordinance. The change would change the pricing of those units, pull that pricing down to 65% of the median income. The current language calls for pricing of units so they're affordable for households earning up to 80% of an area median income, and that there is and the reasoning behind it was that there is this additional subsidy you've heard about. I know in the context of several projects that have come before you in the past couple of years, that the need to for the community to provide that additional subsidy to make these units come down to a price that's affordable, in line with the folks who are served specifically by the land trust, the home trust rather, and in conjunction with other agencies too. There is also this, there was this proposal to actually just make an equivalent change in the percentage of units provided in conjunction with the reduction of the price. And so there's just a proportional reduction of from 80% down to 65 and from 15% affordable down to 12. We got 12.5 when we did the numbers, but so we put 12.5 in the ordinance. In addition to that, there is one other section that's in the draft ordinance, and that deals with the so anyway, this is the summary of what's in the draft ordinance, and the third bullet point is the third point that I haven't noted yet, which is in section 15188, there's the other kind of part of the ordinance that has this real trigger effect on the talking about the provision of affordable housing within a development is the size-limited housing requirements. And in that part of the ordinance, there is, as you probably all remember, a requirement for 25% size-limited housing. And if someone provides, right now the language is 85% of the density bonus they would otherwise be able to provide under the density bonus provision of the ordinance, then they don't have to provide 25% affordable. And that usually translates into something like 15, 16, or 17%, depends on how many units you're, you know, what the base number of units you're working from is. But they get to reduce their size-limited units basically down to the provision of about 15% affordable. So there's that relationship there. So anyway, in order to also bring that number down and consistent with the rest of these changes, the ordinance suggests that that threshold would be 69% instead of 85% of affordable housing density bonus units. So the draft ordinance does allow anybody who's in the process to choose to utilize whichever provision they would be under, but that language has been in there. We had a project, I guess, before us, Litchfield, and they have gotten through the process now. So I don't believe there are any projects in place, Marty, that are looking at using the density bonus right now. So we have provided, have asked for, over the course of, you know, a number of months, some additional time to look at this topic, and for a variety of reasons have not yet formulated a proposal, an alternative, or an additional piece of this to bring to you. And in looking at what data is out there currently, the timing of the release of the new American Community Survey data, which is the sort of the substitute for the detailed information that the census used to provide, as well as some of the census data that will be coming out next year, we feel like we'd be in a better position to understand what the supply and demand kinds of issues are in Carborough related to affordable housing if we were to wait and evaluate those and then consider these changes. And that would give us an opportunity as well to take stock of our housing stock, look at, you know, part of the information from the community survey is information about home ownership ratio, you know, percentages and the cost of home ownership, I mean, the value of people's homes who own them, and that sort of thing. And so we could also look at that in conjunction with tax values of residential property. We have now created a land use map for the town. We can look at single-family properties versus multifamily in our GIS and get some sense of those things. So anyway, we would suggest that we have some time to consider the data as well as some of these other
Can I ask questions. You a question? With that, what you just mentioned, a map with the single-family housing, do you look upon rental housing that has unrelated folk, not in a covenant relationship, as a preacher said 2 weeks ago, as single-family, or do you deem that as multifamily?
We would only deem a multifamily situation or duplex one where there was more than one dwelling unit on a lot.
Okay.
So, or I mean, it could be it could be an accessory right, unit, but it would be more than one. So that would be more than one. So, not based on occupancy.
Okay.
We can't look at occupancy. I mean, from our information, GIS right. information. So there'll be some idea of that from the census, people, unrelated individuals living together, and that sort of thing.
Would you use that information?
Well, we can't directly correlate it with our land use map. We can't bring it down to that level.
Right.
So it would just be descriptive of the community. It would,
right.
But it wouldn't be tied in a more detailed fashion to value or anything like that.
But you would bring that information back to us?
Yes.
Okay.
Dan?
Yeah, I just wanted to remind everyone that there were really two pieces, from my perspective, that went into this proposal. One was the couple of million dollars of subsidies
right.
for future that Robert laid out for us at the Assembly of Governments, whenever that was, a year and a half ago or so. But tied to that is my representing the town on the home consortium and seeing how little money there actually is relative to the need in the community, all the things we would like to do. And I have to say, sitting here today and looking at the prospects in the federal budget, certainly over the next 2 years, if not beyond, you know, we will be very fortunate if those funds are not decreased from where they are. So you know, a method where we're creating affordable housing and not encumbering the taxpayers or our own budget, indefinitely to support that, I think, is pretty important. Or else, you know, alternative to that is to really philosophically say, well, we think, irrespective of those funds, this is something that the taxpayers of Carrboro should support. But that would be very different from what we've done in the past. But yeah, so. So anyway, so I think this is, it's important. You know, it's not going to help us in terms of where the land trust already is with the existing units, but I think in terms of what we're creating in the future, it's going to eliminate that need for subsidy. And Robert and I, are you planning to speak tonight, Robert? Okay. We spent a lot of time, working on those figures, and I know we worked with Trish on them. The other thing I want to comment on, the planning board recommendation,
and
they have two parts in their recommendation, attachment C, and I don't think we should postpone doing this draft ordinance, because I think even as an interim measure, it's better than where we are now. But I do think that we need to review our affordable housing policy. And I think that, one thing, I was looking at the last census data, and, you know, we've had some change then, but there hasn't been a huge change in the overall makeup of the housing stock in Carrboro. And we have, Trish, maybe you know this number offhand, but it's, you know, close to 70% that is not owner-occupied housing. And so I think, you know, and we're really different, say, from Chapel Hill in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Jackie, I guess you were on the board when the 15% number was created. I don't know if you were, Joel. And so maybe one of you knows where that comes from. But it seems very arbitrary to me. And it doesn't seem grounded in what we know we need. And I think what we know, I mean, we don't really know what that 70%, you know, rental and multifamily and all means in terms of meeting our affordability needs. We need some analysis of that. But what we do know is that we want new neighborhoods to have diversity. And by diversity, I don't think any one of us on this board means just really expensive and you know, on the one hand, and subsidized on the other.
Right.
And we have no mechanism at all in mind to get there. So, you know, I was thinking, you know, I spoke at the last time this came up about Spencer Cowan at the planning school, who Trish has been in touch with. And, you know, maybe he would be willing to work with us in a work session discussion to kind of talk about these questions and lend his insight in terms of how we can approach getting a handle on both what our real affordability needs are in Carrboro and what kinds of mechanisms we might be able to develop to actually meet them. So I guess, you know, that's my thinking at this point in the discussion, kind of in the context of the planning. One is to go ahead with what we have tonight, but then to try and do something more comprehensive in the, you know, sometime in the months ahead. And maybe I shouldn't be saying all that since it's a public hearing before we hear from the public.
Well, but, and I'm not sure Teresa's even done with her presentation, but
okay. Well, I can wait because I've written notes down.
Lydia,
I'm sorry. Were you not done with your presentation?
Well, I think, you know, I was only going to say that we did. I mean, I did provide some information, sort of the discussion of some of those points in this agenda item. And that there are some strategies that we've identified as possible ones to actually to incorporate into revisions to this draft ordinance. We did not provide a resolution of consistency, you know, for you to use as part of adopting the ordinance tonight. We just provided an alternative, a resolution that would for you to direct us to pursue some of the things that are noted in the agenda item, and that they do address, but they do require us to be able to get some more information about what's going on in the community to really understand the sizes of houses that have been provided in the past 10 years. The last time we updated that information was when we created, I think, the size limited housing requirements back in 1999. So we haven't looked at that comprehensively since that time. As well as, and so looking at diversity of housing kind of things within developments, essentially, as a proxy or substitute, perhaps, as an expansion of our size-limited housing provision or in conjunction, in some other way, in conjunction with affordable housing density bonus or whatever. So, I spoke specifically with Spencer Cowan about the some of the mechanisms that are needed to some of the kinds of information that we would need to really begin to understand some of those questions. You know, what is our workforce housing requirement? What is this? You know, what is the labor shed? What is, you know, those kinds of things. And he was very helpful, and you know, he's has some good ideas about expediting review and ways to incorporate, you know, maybe look at some changes to standards that apply to affordable housing. So there are some things that I noted here that we would be exploring specifically further to bring back to you. But it would really be in conjunction with us getting some more information. The American Community Survey information is supposed to come out in December, and that's I think Carrboro will be represented. We're supposed to be represented. Depends on who responded to the survey, you know. So, and sent their information in.
Okay. Well, that sounds like a good plan to me.
Lydia and then Joel.
Okay. I was just going to address briefly the planning board's recommendation. They started after examining the ordinance, they started kind of a lengthy discussion of wanting to get more educated on current stock and talking to different folks about affordable housing strategies, and Damon's here, he can correct me if I'm wrong, but the planning board was really kind of interested in doing a little bit of extra research or work on this also to help aid us in kind of getting some information brought back to us over the coming months. And as for the draft ordinance, it wasn't necessarily that they voted against it or voted for it. It was almost that they just didn't consider it. They said, rather than look at this, you know, we want to undertake kind of a review. They didn't feel strongly one way or the other about the ordinance. So,
Joel, and then Robert Dowling.
I know the work that's gone into this, but philosophically, I can't remember a number from 15% to 12.5% without having some other balance to it. I mean, I agree. I think the data is out there. There is no middle. You either can afford to live here and write a big check, or you're being subsidized in some fashion and you're writing a smaller check, but we're also writing a big check.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no, when I moved to Carrboro, I'm telling my age, 1992. Ooh, I was young then. I'm just teasing now. I think there was a middle. I don't have a sense that there is a middle anymore. You either can write a check and get a loan for between $250,000 and $350,000 or more if you can afford it, or you are being subsidized. And while I understand the work that's gone into it, I think that we're going to, for me at least, if I'm going to support something that reduces the proportion that's required when somebody gets a permit, then there have got to be some incentives for people doing affordable or middle housing, moderate, and there got to be some disincentives for folks that want to do big housing. And while I understand what the economy is, because I did have a good discussion with Omar at Weaver Street, and I understand the pressures, I'm unwilling to make a change based on the bad economic right now without some further information to support such a change that would actually, in fact, reduce the amount of affordable housing. And that's my position.
Yes, Robert.
And I've told this to Robert at Weaver Street, too, so nobody's surprised.
Mark, I'm not signed up.
Yeah, I figured. You can be next, Omar.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Robert Dowling from the Community Home Trust. First and foremost, everything that I do is oriented to creating successful inclusionary housing in both Chapel Hill and Carrboro. We only have 20 homes in Carrboro, but there are 20 nice homes in Claremont, Pacifica, Crest Street, Broad Street, Eugene Street, Mulberry, and there's more coming in Claremont. And there's been other developments we've approved, Butler, the Alberta, Roberson Square, that may or may not ever be built. And I think you approved Claremont 2 across the street on the south side of the street that Omar will talk to you more about, which includes some affordable housing, which ultimately may not. So my objective is to create successful inclusionary housing neighborhoods. Why? Because I think it's the best type of development we can have. Rather than have the neighborhoods where these houses are all 300,000 and up, this neighborhood's 500,000 and up, having people living together, to me, makes the most sense. I think it can be done. I think it can be done successfully. It adds, at a minimum, it adds economic diversity, at a minimum. It most likely also adds racial and ethnic diversity to neighborhoods. I think those are all good things. What's not good is what you guys talked about is this barbell effect. That everything is $500,000 and above except our homes, which are $100,000. It would be far preferable to have some $200,000 homes and some $250,000 and some $150,000 and some $100,000, I think, and not have 85% at $500,000 and 15% at $100,000. Dan's point about the subsidy is, I think, absolutely right on. They're going to be cutting something in this federal budget, and I don't think home and CDBG funds are high on the list of things that can't be touched. So that could hurt in the future. Something else that is a factor is that our median income limits, which, as you guys remember me sort of doing hand signals, have been flat since 2004. And we projected, when we told the assembly governments in 2007, that was, Dan, we projected they'd be flat through 2012. Well, this year they just went down. We didn't project that they would go down. They went down, and we have an indication from HUD that they may go down again. That works against us. That means we need more subsidy. I'm trying to throw out a bunch of factors that I just tried to scribble down as you all were talking. The town of Chapel Hill has asked us, formally asked us, to look at serving incomes higher than 80% of median. And I think they specified up to 120% of median income. We're working with the UNC Law Clinic on that very question. And it seems that it may be safe for us from a 501c3 perspective to work with people, families, up to 115% of median. Just for point of reference, 115% for a family of four is about $75,000 in income. And when you think about affordable housing, you don't think about people who make $75,000. But that's not a one-person household, young person working at Red Hat making $75,000. It's two teachers, each making $35,000.
With two kids.
With two kids. And combined, they make $72,000. That's who we're talking about. Two young people who work over at UNC. We deal with these people all the time who can't buy homes from us. Two start-out teachers, starting out public schools, make way too much money. So the market, the average price of a home that sold this year, 2010, Chapel Hill and Carborough, I didn't split out Carborough, $380,000.
Hey, see, I told you.
$380,000 as of November 6th. That was 658 properties. There's a long way between where we sell homes, we're like 150 and down, and 380. There's a lot of people that get caught in there, that 200,000, 250,000. It would be ideal if we could figure out how to serve that. If this organization decides to go up to 115% of median, and there's a long ways before we would do that, we would cover some of that ground, some of it, but not all of it. The way the town's ordinance is structured, and I might have this wrong, but Trish will correct me, is it's a voluntary inclusionary housing ordinance whereby a developer is not required to do it. You don't say to developers, you have to do 15%. You say you have to do 25% small houses. And alternatively, you can do 15% affordable houses. I think that's how it works. Something like that.
Yes.
What we're realizing is that developers, the market in 03 and 04 and 05 and 06, the market was strong enough that the developers could pay for the affordable houses with the market rate houses. They have to make money on their development. They absolutely have to, and we want them to. I want them to, and you all should want them to. Because if they don't make money, they go out of business, asset values decline, and we don't get any affordable housing. The equation has shifted from 02 or 03 or 04 or 05 or 06. The equation has shifted. I wrote a memo that I have with me to the planning board November 13th, 2009, which I reread today. I think it's a pretty good memo.
Nice work.
Normally yours are.
And it talks about how an ordinance, if it's a voluntary ordinance, if it's not economically compelling to a developer, and Omar, I'm sure, will speak to this, we're not going to get any affordable housing. Joe, I understand your point. You don't want to drop 15 down to 12. But if Omar's saying, I can't do it, and I'm going to have to build the 25% small houses, and they'll be small, but they'll still be $250,000, we solved one of our problems. We hit that middle ground, but we lost the affordable units. And what we lost is any kind of permanency to the affordability as well, because they're unrestricted.
Let me just ask you this question. Mm-hmm. When it improved, what then? Because here's my issue. We're in a depression. People like to say we're having a rebound, but America doesn't make anything that anybody else wants to buy. You know, let's stop trying to make it pretty or make it cute. We don't make anything that anybody wants to buy. Ask the Germans. That's the problem with us doing that $600 trillion worth of making more money at the time. So I understand what the economics is. My problem is, where is that safeguard some 10 years down the road when the economy does improve? On the one hand, And then on the other hand, the limited amount of land remaining, because we've got an urban service boundary where we've said we are not going to extend, at least for the next 18 years or 17 years, because we executed it again, we're not going to let both water or sewer in that area. Mm-hmm. So it's all the land left Eubanks and south, between Homestead and Eubanks. That's all that's left. Nobody's farming, hardly, in that space. Mm-hmm. So eventually people are going to die, and their heirs are going to sell that property. And while it may be too close to a landfill, landfill's going to be closed. So next thing you know, there's going to be something there that people are going to want to be, and people are going to be there, and they're putting another in the future, another middle school. Mm-hmm. So where does the trigger point come when the economy improves?
I think your point is absolutely correct. I agree with you 100%. And what I would do, though, is look at that through a different lens and say, because the land is all going to be gone in the next 10 years, if the incentives aren't there for people to do the affordable housing in the next 10 years, we're not going to get any. Because the land will be gone.
I'm just saying there maybe need to be other incentives.
And so I think the long story short, I know I'm talking too long, Mr. Mayor, I really want, you guys know I live here, I love this town, and I want to see inclusionary housing be successful. I support the planning board. I suggested in my memo from November of last year that we really take a step back and take a look at this thing. And Dan came up with a great idea, and I still support it. But I don't think it's enough. I don't think it's enough. We're still not going to get any inclusionary housing. So I would support the planning board's idea that we really, that group or some other group, take a step back and we really look at it. And we have to understand what we want. And if we understand what we want, we can figure out how to get it. And if we want houses along a continuum, I think there's ways that we can do that. So I appreciate you all listening to me. And if anybody wants a copy of this well-written memo I wrote last year, I'd be happy to share it.
You can email it to me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Robert.
Thank you, Robert.
Omar.
Well, we do make iPods, Joel. I just wanted to mention that.
Actually, they're designed in California. They are built in China.
We make a lot of software. But,
that's all I have to say.
I mean, I've spoken to pretty much every one of you guys, and I don't want to sound too redundant up here, but I do want to make a few points related to inclusionary zoning or related to the current affordable housing ordinance and related to its sustainability. Just backing up in 02 or 03, we actually created the first affordable housing ordinance in Chapel Hill. And we came up with the 15% number with Mayor Foy at that time. And it was more of an arbitrary number. It was, you know, a number that sounded good that we thought that we could do. And obviously the housing market at that time was robust and was actually the strongest from 03 to 06 was the strongest housing market that this country's ever known. So, you know, that's when that ordinance was created. And, you know, fast forward to present day, and, you know, we're building affordable housing out in Claremont, as you know. And most of you already also know that, you know, we have our most current duplex, which we finished in May. We're supposed to go under contract. We're supposed to close in May. Got pushed back to June. Ultimately, the first side of that duplex closed in November, May to November, June, July, August, September, October, November. That's 6 months later. And now we have a contract on the other side, which is supposed to close the end of January. November, December, January. So, you know, it's 8 months later. When we build an affordable home or duplex, whatever it may be, you know, we build it, we sell it at a fixed price predetermined by the mean income in Orange County and government forces. Permit fees are up. OWASA fees are up. Interest rates are going up. But when we're finished with that unit, I mean, there's really no mechanism set in place to immediately sell that and transfer that to the community, the Housing Land Trust. So we might finish a unit, and you never know when they might take it over. So regardless of, you know, what happens tonight, there needs to be some mechanism in place that actually either forces a sale or that at tax on interest for the time that additional time that property's held. Right now, it's just we're just paying another interest fee every month, every month, every month. So when we build a unit, I mean, I've talked with people who said, well, you know, you can just sell it to as a market rate unit. Well, the inside of that house is completely different. The outside looks the exact same, but when we build one of these units, and most of you already know this, we give the land away for free, and we still sell the unit at a $15,000 to $20,000 loss. That's a fact. It takes a robust housing market to subsidize our affordable housing units. And it's not a robust housing market right now. I mean, that was 03 to 06, one of the best moments in history. That's when the ordinance was created. So, you know, you guys know I'm a Carrboro resident. You know, I grew up at Stony Hill right behind Hogan's Farm. You know, I've seen the transformation in the countryside. And, you know, I understand, well, we don't want to reduce what we're already getting. But, you know, questions of equity, you know, come to mind. And I've mentioned, I know it's not a popular option, you know, why do only developers have to provide affordable housing in Carrboro? If this is a policy that the town of Carrboro believes in, should not all businesses or all people in the town of Carrboro support affordable housing? Of course that's never going to happen. But to me, that seems just. So, you know, that's where we're at. And, you know, as Robert mentioned, you know, right now, when you have two options, you know, and I'm on the agenda the beginning of December, so I don't want to go too much into my idea that I have of converting Claremont 2 to 25% size-limited housing to provide additional market options without affordable housing. I'm not going to get into that tonight. Robert mentioned it, and I'm on the docket for December, but currently, as it stands, you can either go one of two routes. You know, you can either provide the 25% affordable housing. 3 years ago, when we started Claremont 2, I mean, that option wasn't very politically popular. Or you can go the density bonus route. When you go the density bonus route, you take your mean density, what your neighborhood averages out to, and then you get one affordable house for one more market house, one affordable house for one market house. And it should work out to an even number. But if you don't meet 85% of your max density, 85% Marty, if you don't meet
85% of the total number of affordables you could do.
Correct, which would be 150% of your actual density. Then you have to provide 15% affordable housing. So, for instance, across the street, we're building 21 bonus units above and beyond our mean density, which is 75. But out of those 21 additional bonus units, 16 are affordable and 5 are market rate. So it's really not a one-to-one bonus. In this case, it works out to do a 1-for-3 bonus, 3 affordable units, you get 1 market rate unit. In addition, that increases the density in the neighborhood.
Because what you're help me out, what you're getting at is in part is because, you know, the sort of theoretical number of units under the density bonus that could fit on say, for one example, the property where Claremont 2 is yeah. supposed to go, they just don't fit on that property.
Multifamily. You might reach a one-to-one ratio, and you're going to take up the numbers a lot higher.
Right.
So, we're at a 3-to-1 ratio, and it's increasing the density in the neighborhood drastically. And I know you guys want density, but what does the market want? You know, when you have an option to buy something on a tenth of an acre, an eighth of an acre, or you can go in downtown Carver and buy a half acre, even though you've got a green neighborhood, you know, with low VOC paints, you know, balanced air systems, you know, regionally imported products. I mean, people don't care. They want the land. So it's a matter of balancing the market needs, you know, what's equitable, and the component of sustainability. Because minus 20K, every house that is sold or eventually sells, to me, is not equitable. So, you know, I've said my piece. You know, I'm not trying to stand up here and toot my horn, but, you know, I'm a local business person, a local resident, and, you know, that's where I would hope, you know, to see the focus and to have ears and eyes think about not just a one-sided game, not just a one-sided coin, you know, but, you know, what is equitable? What is sustainable? Because this is not. So if anybody has any questions, I'd be glad to answer them, but I'm sorry if I sat up here and spoke for quite a time, but it's very important to me.
Thanks,
so thank you for your time.
Thanks, Omar.
All right.
Good Thanksgiving.
And thanks for all the good stuff you do. Yeah. Because you do a lot of good stuff, and we appreciate
you.
It.
Well, this should be easy. what do y'all want to do with this?
I'll move attachment A.
Oh, good.
But if Joel wants to do something more complicated, we can do that.
No. I'll move attachment A.
You can't. There's a motion on the floor.
I'll second attachment A. But I would ask for sort of additional information that I'd like to have, since mm-hmm. we're not voting on the ordinance itself.
Right. Attachment A is a resolution accepting the staff report and directing staff to modify the draft ordinance.
Right. I think the kind of information I want from the staff when it comes back to us, of course, is the income information. But again, I want a comparison between when we started with this 15% and where we are now. So actually raw numbers. And I also want, for example, because I think those are available since Robert mentioned the $380,000 thing. I sort of want for any housing that's owner-occupied and owner-owned, just sort of what we've seen over the last, and let's take the robust years to date on, you know, those categories of whatever, 200,000, 250, 300, 350, 400, 450. And also, if we can do it, size in a similar fashion, both attached and unattached. I may ask some more after I sleep over it, and I'll just send it.
If the income levels that we're going to hear about, if the incomes are to really have any meaning when it comes to housing, we've got to ferret out students.
Yeah.
Because we have so many of our renters are students. If you go to my stepdaughter and ask her her income, she will tell you it's $15,000 a year. She lives a little beyond that. And so do a lot of them. So we can't have, because if you count student income, we look really, really poor. You know, poorer than we are. So there has got to be a way to, like, I don't know how you do it, but there's got to be a way to filter students out of that equation. Excuse it.
Would you mind if I piggyback on that for
sure.
1 second? Thank you. I would just point out, just in the last few minutes, on my laptop, I took a look at the Triangle MLS system, and you know what's more interesting than 380,000 being an average is that if you restrict it to looking at new construction houses in the Chapel Hill Carborough School District, 380,000 is that's the entry point. That's not the average. That's
right.
the bottom rung of the ladder is $380,000. There are 36 new homes for sale right now in Chapel Hill and Carborough, single-family detached homes. Three of them are under 400,000. Six of them are over a million. So, the only reason I point that out is not any criticism of the people who are doing that, but just to say, you know, it's not just a question of what our housing stock is, but look at what we're adding.
Well,
that's
yeah.
all we're adding, you know,
right.
other than through land trust or habitat.
No,
or
that's a good one.
You know, anyway.
I just wanted to add that as part of what we study or look at over the next months with regard to affordable housing, that we address this concern that Omar has brought up, study it, what happens when a developer builds it, it's ready, and they have to hold on to it for several months. You know, what, if anything, can be done about that? So I just don't want to lose sight of that problem. Mm-hmm. So.
And do we want to... I think I like Robert's point on what is our ultimate goal. Do we want to consider thinking about that full spectrum and how to possibly, or how to explore, how to, you know, incentivize that big gap, providing housing within that big gap?
I mean, you know, I think the other question, the sort of, I mean, I've tried to make this point before, but, you know, there's also a gap
below.
Immediately below,
right. Right.
You know, and
should we let Chapel Hill do that gap, and we'll do below?
Well, no, I mean, I'm, you know, there are a lot of people who live in both in Chapel Hill and Carborough who live on almost nothing but Social Security disability income,
right.
Which means they live on less than $10,000 a year. There are a lot of people.
I have one other point. This is not for. Staff, this is just for our speculation over the holidays, is you know, one of the recommendations of the Simpson-Bowles committee was to eliminate the deductibility of mortgage interest. And you know, so it's an interesting question whether that's going to change the whole phenomenon of home ownership versus renting, you know, just as a social condition in the
Isn't
United
that amazing?
States.
I bet they're both.
Well, I mean, not that necessarily is going to happen. You
well,
know,
neither of them are making house payments. That's cool.
Exactly. And the truth of the matter is, studies have shown that children who live in homes that are owner-occupied do better in school.
Oh, I'm not arguing that point. I'm
just
saying, you know, if that gained traction.
They don't care about that.
Yeah.
Because then if the kids are doing worse in school, you don't have to provide the schools as good because they're too dumb, so why put money in them? So there's your excuse.
Because you're going to have more charter schools.
Exactly.
Okay. But you're not going to be able to get in them.
All right, so the resolution has been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed. Matter passed unanimously. Is there?
I have another item.
Oh, we love you.
Public hearing. Yeah.
Well, I move that we approve the manager's proposed holiday leave plan that he emailed us about.
I'll second that.
Second.
Been moved and seconded that week. Mr. Manager, could you just briefly describe to the public what the proposal is?
Yes,
right now, employees are scheduled to be off in administrative offices closed December 23rd, 24th, and 27th. The proposal was to, for this year only, to be closed and give days off December 20th through 24th and reopen on Monday, December 27th. So a net of two increased holidays for this year only.
And sort of a reconfiguration so that most town employees would get a solid week off.
Right. That's correct.
But we'll still have make arrangements, obviously police and fire.
Police, fire,
do it differently.
Sanitation.
Trash collection.
All those trash collection, all those services will be provided, but the administrative offices would be closed for that week.
All right. That's not to say that we won't find a way to make it equal for people who work in those departments. We're just going to do it a different way in those departments.
Everybody will get an extra 2 days, but those folks who shift work and otherwise will just have to take those days off at a different time. But a large majority of our employees would be allowed to have 5 consecutive days.
Okay.
Great.
All right. It's been moved and seconded. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
I just want to say we so appreciate our town employees and all that y'all do, not only those of you who show up at our meetings here in Town Hall and that we see around Town Hall, but everybody who works for
everyone home glued to the cable channel.
Well, no, I meant more, you know, there's all kinds of town employees that at Public Works, for example,
yeah.
that
we
hardly ever see. And anyway, we appreciate all.
Every employee will be most appreciative. I know that because I've talked with almost all of them. So thank you all very much.
I was wondering if are we going to hear from the plan for sustainable forestry management? Do we know if anyone's coming from the Wasatch share?
I think they're inviting us to go to them.
Yeah, they're having a meeting on November 30th, which is next week, which we won't meet because of Fifth Tuesday. But
okay, I'll just go there.
Right. Okay. And please let us know if there's something we need to know about. All right, is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Been moved and seconded by Jackie. All those in favor signify by saying aye. All those opposed, matter passes.